from KQED. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I am Scott Schaefer. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We are so happy you snuck away from your families, perhaps, to join us for this special holiday show.
We are. Hopefully they're all behaving. And, you know, while this weekend most Americans are at home with loved ones, next week our leaders will be back in Washington, D.C., and we expect something pretty important to happen.
Yeah, there's a little bit of talk going around right now. Democrats in the House have scheduled a caucus vote on their next leader. And, of course, whoever wins will be considered by the full Congress on January 3rd to take over as Speaker of the House.
And you know who wants that gavel back?
Who could that be?
San Francisco Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. So, you know, we thought this might be a good time to listen back to our interview with her. Scott and I talked with her at the end of August. And later we'll be hearing from two former congressmen who want to see more bipartisanship in Washington.
Exactly. We'll see how that goes. But first, here's Minority Leader, at least for now, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
You know, you grew up in a really political family in
Yes.
Baltimore. Your dad was mayor. Your brother was mayor. Your
Yeah.
dad was a congressman as well. And when we were thinking about this, we're curious kind of like what you learned from them, especially when it comes to the attacks we see on you by Republicans very often.
Yeah.
Do you think you learned some thick skin and lessons from watching them?
And how to punch back.
Well, as I always say to the candidates, you have to know how to take a punch and throw a punch. No, I mean, what we learned growing up, what we were instilled with the idea that public service was a noble calling and to respect all those who engaged in it because we all have a responsibility to each other. That was engendered. And the Democrats and Republicans in those days fought because we had different philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But they had different philosophies. I said we, the adults. But there were personal friendships. It wasn't the way it is now, the politics of personal destruction. And so you would learn to respect other people's views, to have the humility to respect other people's views. And so that's what I learned, and that's what, but I also learned how to count votes.
I think you were called Little Nancy when you were
yeah.
a little girl, and there's a picture in your office of you and President Kennedy when
yeah.
you were how old?
A teenager, like
a teenager,
16,
yeah. But I'm wondering, you know, back to what Marisa said, your dad must have been attacked while he was in
all
politics.
The time.
Yeah,
all the time.
And so as his daughter, what was that like for you? And what did you take away from that other than how to count votes?
Well, it just goes with the territory. Yeah, as President Truman is famous for saying in history, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. This is the arena. You decide to enter the arena. And you decide that you're going to make decisions to advance public policy, to improve the lives of people. And there are other people who are agents of the status quo who will oppose that. This is what it is. If you can't take it, then don't do it.
But you get criticized for a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I won't list the litany, but are there things that you think that's really not fair versus, well, you know, there's some truth in that?
I think everything is fair game. I don't pay that much attention to it, but the fact is that they go after you if you're effective, and that's what I did learn growing up. If you're not effective, they don't even care what you do. But I'm effective, master legislator, says she immodestly, and I say this because I want women to hear me assert myself because I want them to assert themselves, and women sometimes hesitate to do that. I'm respected as a master legislator, and I love being a legislator. I'm effective in terms of raising money more than anybody who hasn't run for president of the United States.
$660 million.
But they have to undo me. You know, in other words, in their fundraising letters, they say we have to stop her because she attracts so much money. And why do I? Because I'm effective and because I have a plan. I have values, a vision for our future, a plan to get it done, and a plan to win. So they have to stop that. So I take it, if I were not effective, they wouldn't be coming at me. When I was sworn in as speaker and I had the children around me, it was quite a moment. But people said to me after, you've just made yourself a great big target for the Republicans because they have to take you down. And so, you know, that's That's the way it is.
So you said a moment ago you never thought you'd run for office.
No.
And I know you were very involved in Democratic politics in California before you did. Did someone ask you to run? Because we hear a lot women need to be asked.
Yeah, I did. Congresswoman Sala Burton asked me to run. And I really had never. I loved promoting other people. I was chair of the California Democratic Party, northern chair, state chair, that. I loved that, promoting other people, shared values about all of the things we want to advancing equality in every way in our society, as well as protecting our environment and a fair economy, all the ease, education and the rest. But then Congresswoman Sala Burton, unbeknownst to me in terms of the seriousness of her illness, was very ill. And she said to me, you have to come see me. I want you. But she said, I don't want you to run for mayor. I know everybody wants you to run for mayor. And I was like, I'm not running for mayor. I grew up in that atmosphere. It's wonderful, but I'll leave that for others. And then she said, well, you should run. You love the issues. You should be in Congress. And I, hesitated because I had never, I never planned to run.
Never went through your mind.
Never went through my mind. I had been asked before to run for office, but I completely rejected it because when I was asked before, I had like five teenagers. And I said, you must be kidding. I have five teenagers. Why would I run for office? At that time, I was chair of the California Democratic Party. That's a volunteer.
What office do they want you to run for?
Well, we won't go into that right now.
Okay.
But when it came time when the Congress, I did go to my youngest child, Alexandra, who was going to be a senior in high school. I said, Alexandra, Mommy's been asked to run for Congress. It would be better if it were one more year when you would be in college. Any answer is fine. I love my life. I love being here with you. But I'd be gone like three nights a week for a certain number of months. If I won, I don't even know if I'll win. I'm just going to run. But I won't do it if you want me to be here with you. To which she said, and this is 30 years ago, Mother, not Mommy, Mother, get a life.
What so, a teenage answer.
Yeah, I know, but I had never heard the expression. You have to understand, that's common talk now, but then it was, get a life.
Do you think they ever regretted? Did you think she ever regretted that?
No, what she then said was, what teenage girl wouldn't want her mother out of the house three nights a week? So, no, she didn't get it. But, no, I don't think so. But she herself she loved radio. What I later learned is that she was sneaking out at night to do the nighttime shift, whatever you call it.
Late overnight.
At USF, because they had a great radio
KUSF.
Station.
Funny. Yeah. I want to ask you a question about your faith, because you're a devout Catholic, I think. Is that
yes,
fair to say?
True.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And how often do you go to Mass?
Regularly. I go every week.
Every week, yeah. So how do you—
At least every week.
How do you negotiate the positions of the church on things like gay marriage, gay rights, on the death penalty, although the Pope now has said the death penalty is wrong. But, there are a lot of issues that you and many other Democrats espouse that are in conflict with the church. How do you deal with that?
Well, it's not in conflict with my conscience and as well as how I was raised as a Catholic. I was raised as an Italian-American community in Baltimore, Maryland, in Little Italy, in an enclave there, and we were taught that every person was really important. So from the standpoint of LGBTQ issues, that was how we were raised. It was never anything different than we respect people for who they are.
But as you know, the church has, in the past, gone after people like John Kerry, because they were pro-choice.
Right. Pro-choice is another issue. I do believe that, and this is not a view that is universally shared in my own family. They're not rabid pro-life, but they are more in the pro-life position. So I understand that we have a difference of opinion. But I do believe that God has given us all a free will and given us a responsibility to live accordingly and honor our responsibilities. And I do believe as a mother of five, I have five children. When Alexandra came home from the hospital that week, my oldest child was turning six. So, I'm with the program, but that doesn't mean other people have to be with the program. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like I said to my colleagues, any one of you has had five children in 6 years, let's have a conversation about contraception, birth control, Planned Parenthood, and the rest.
So, five kids under the age of six.
Oh, six and under.
Six and under. You talked earlier about that you are effective and sort of the things you do, which include raising money and passing legislation. I guess first I'm curious of having those kids and having that experience you think has helped you in Congress.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, I'll tell you. Let's hear it for parents. Having a family is a wonderful thing. It is also a challenge, right? You have to be masters of how you manage time, personalities, responsibilities, and the rest. And when you raise five children under six and under in that period of time, when they are all in school all day, you think you can do anything. You know, and it's like, bring it on from 8:30 to 3:30. Bring it on. And because you have been so energized by your responsibility, there is no room for error.
Right. Is that similar, being a leader? I mean, because I want to hear you talk about, like, what do you bring to that? There's a lot of talk about whether it's time for new leadership. And I think you've said right here that you feel like you're very good at your job.
Yes.
What is that job?
Well, here's what I consider. As I said, as a master legislator, I consider myself sort of a weaver. I'm like at a loom, and I have all these beautiful threads that come together, some very different under the tent of the diversity of the Democratic Party. And what I need to do is to make sure that every thread is in the fabric of what we are putting together without any this is better than that or anything like that. So I consider myself being at a loom, working with my colleagues to design what this tapestry will be. And that is what the unity is. And when we win all of these votes, people say, how do you keep them together? I said, I don't. Our shared values keep us together because we weave all of this together.
I just want to say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, along with Marisa Lagos. We're talking with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Keeping the caucus together. Give some specifics. What do you do to keep that loyalty and to keep people together?
Well, first let me just brag that our caucus is over 50% women, people of color, and LGBTQ community members. And that makes us historic in the history of the world. A political party has not had that kind of diversity. And it will even be more numbers in all of those categories when we win in November, which we intend to do. So we have diversity of generation, of geography, of ethnicity, of gender identity, you name it. We have this beautiful diversity. And we have a lot of respect for everybody's perspective as to what their priorities are. So we build by consensus. I don't come in with a piece of paper and say, here's what it is, everybody sign up. This is the challenge. These are the possibilities. We're not going to the lowest common denominator. We're going to the boldest common denominator. And when we make those decisions, people just stay on board, like 100% voting against the unfair tax bill that gives 83% of the benefits to the top 1%. In some people's districts, that was presented in a way that might sound appealing.
Is it personal relationships with them?
Like, well, yeah, you have to understand people's motivation, their district, their priorities, and how. Again, though, everybody's in the discussion, in the consensus. Affordable Care Act, Dodd-Frank, the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, to stimulus package, just the list goes on of things where we're together.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back with more of our interview with Nancy Pelosi. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
You're listening to a Thanksgiving special of Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. Here with me across the dinner table, Marisa Lagos. Pass the stuffing.
It's mine.
We're going to jump back into our interview right now with Nancy Pelosi from earlier this year. As you know, there is a challenge to your leadership. You're the minority leader now, and there are people running for office who are promising not to vote for you for speaker. And I know you said, do what you need to do to
That's
win.
That's right.
Yeah. But come December, January, when, if you win back the House,
when
when you went back to the House, if you went, what do you just say to those folks, okay, now let's get real. I'm the best person. What do you do?
Well, yeah, I will say I'm the best person. None of us is indispensable. We know that. But I do think by dint of my experience, because in addition to not ever wanting to run for running for Congress, I never was running for leadership. Other people came to me and said, you must run for leadership. And when I did run for a high office and leadership, some of the men said, who said she could run? Well, that just lit my fire, really. Who said she could run? We don't need permission. Well, they had a pecking order from 200 years or so of people who would always be next.
But isn't that kind of what the younger people are criticizing?
Yeah, no, but let me just take issue with that for a moment. I've always had an opponent. I don't think I've ever had, maybe the first time I ran for speaker because I just delivered the majority. Maybe then I wasn't opposed, but I've always been opposed. So that goes with the territory. You have a different point of view. It's just natural. I don't even consider it unusual. But the fact is that I believe I would have walked away from all of this. Anybody who lives in San Francisco doesn't like to get on a plane every week to go to Washington, D.C., that's for sure. But if Hillary had won, I know how important it is to have a woman at the table. I mean, just you cannot just have five people who look very much the same at the table and think that people are going to say, oh, my views are represented there. So when we had President Obama, we had that diversity, and I as a woman as speaker. And then when Hillary, if she won, I knew that the Affordable Care Act would be protected. And I feel very proprietary about the Affordable Care Act, as you can imagine. But she didn't win. And so I thought, okay, I have to give this, I'll stay to make this fight to protect the Affordable Care Act, which I know chapter and verse, what's good about it and what needs to be improved about it, and how to fight them off, as well as being at the table.
It seems like your rhetoric around this question has changed slightly. I've heard you talk about building a bridge and that somebody
have to build a bridge to the future. And that's what we were saying to people. If you want to be the other side of the bridge, get a following.
Show me what you got.
Show me. Get a following. And I don't think that I should be the leader or the speaker or whatever because of what I've done, but what I'm capable of doing.
So the point about just not having a speaker or a minority leader who's a target,
they always be a target. I remember when I was chair of the California Democratic Party, the ads they took out against Tip O'Neill. I wish I had them.
But we don't see this attack from the Democrats, say, on Mitch McConnell.
Well, you don't see it from the press. I mean, the press is, Mitch McConnell has been there a long time. I don't know.
Do you think it has to do with your gender?
There are some people who think that it's misogyny. But
what do you think?
Well, I think that it's because I'm effective. If you saw their fundraising letters, they're like, she is outraising us. She's just a powerful fundraiser. We have to stop her. But they're really more concerned about me being across the table from them because I eat their lunch in every negotiation. It took them five what we call continuing resolutions to realize that they were going to have to agree with us on how we made major investments in our domestic budget in addition to what they wanted to do with the defense budget. Five, from end of September until the spring, when they finally realized we might as well give up.
So closer to home, there are 7 to 10 congressional districts in California that Democrats are going for. You sound pretty confident that Democrats can take back the House.
We have milked California pretty well in terms of the enthusiasm for equal rights and environment and all the rest. And we still think we can win more seats.
I want to transition. We're almost out of time from milk to milk chocolate. I've been to your office a couple times, several times in D.C. There's always all these jars of Ghirardelli chocolate. What is it about chocolate?
It's not milk, though, for me.
Dark chocolate. The dark chocolate.
Really dark. And the darker,
the better.
I
needed the metaphor.
I agree with you.
I got your transition. Now let's transition.
My segue.
It's very dark.
Be accurate, Scott.
Yeah, it's very good for you. I heard once on the radio years ago, since we were on the radio, that eating chocolate was good for your teeth. I immediately changed the station so that I didn't have to hear any counter argument to that. And, I don't know. I just have all my whole life since a little girl loved chocolate. And it is. So when people say, how do you have all this energy? You're on the floor for 8 hours, this and that, and high heel shoes and this and that. I said, I think it's a having raised a family, so you're in high gear all the time, right? I think it's being Italian American. I just have this boundless energy within me. Dark chocolate.
Were you eating chocolate?
Dark chocolate.
During that filibuster, were you eating chocolate?
No, I was. No, I was just drinking water.
Yeah. Well, on that note,
they did give me candy. Some people passed candy, but they were more. They weren't chocolate.
It wasn't chocolate.
More chocolate.
Yeah. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you. Just such an honor to be here, but also to represent this golden state of California, heaven on earth.
And that was, of course, House Minority Leader and Speaker, hopeful Nancy Pelosi, talking with Scott Schaefer and me, Marisa Lagos, on Political Breakdown this summer.
All right. And now we're going to mix it up a little bit. We're going to hear from two former congressmen from Florida. One is a Republican, one is a Democrat. And they've actually been touring the country talking about ways to end what everyone knows exists back there, which is partisan gridlock.
That's right. Our producer, Guy Marzorati, sat down with Republican David Jolly and Democrat Patrick Murphy. Here's some of their conversation.
David Jolly, Patrick Murphy, thanks so much for coming on to Political Breakdown.
Good to be with you today.
Thanks for having us.
So just to start with you, Patrick, you're doing this tour nationwide, town halls. What are the kind of messages that you're getting back or things that you're hearing from people as you make your way across the country?
Yeah, so we've been traveling the state of Florida and really the country, done over 20 events now, mainly at universities, talking about why Congress is so messed up and why the political system's so messed up for that matter. And I think most people agree with that and are seeing it. But we've been able to, I think, kind of pull back the curtain and tell some of the stories from the inside of why that is.
And you both are from swing districts in Florida. Are there things that you see, dynamics you see in swing districts that maybe offer hope for kind of bipartisan work to be done in Congress? We don't see many of those swing districts.
That's right. Without question. And that's probably one of the greatest lessons we learned from our time in Congress. Patrick represented, as a Democrat, a district that leaned a little Republican. Myself, I was a Republican who represented a district that President Obama had won, kind of purely toss-up 50-50 districts. And in our experience in Congress, what we saw was the very, very few members who represent 50-50 districts. It's really about 10% of the Congress. Their decision-making is informed by different incentives. Right? Not only are they fighting for their political life almost every day by having to give voice to that broad constituency, but the inverse is true as well, in that they get rewarded for speaking to broader constituencies. You know, so I was a Republican who was able to speak to my convictions, say, on marriage equality and climate change and gun control. Though I was a Republican, there was a political reward for that, if you will, within the district. If we are able to address gerrymandering, if we're able to address reforms to the primary system, bring in campaign finance reforms as well, ultimately, I think that incentivizes bipartisanship. And though ballot initiatives sometimes seem less sexy and evoke less passion than getting behind a transformational candidate, say like a Beto O'Rourke in Texas, the reality is many of these ballot initiatives are equally as important as the candidates we decide to support.
Well, here in California, we're all about ballot initiatives. Right. We've had 17 on the ballot 2 years ago, 11 on the ballot this November. I'm wondering if you see some of the reforms that have happened in California, particularly around gerrymandering and handing the redistricting over to citizens and a citizens commission, if that something like that might be the way forward in other states that face a more severe gerrymandering problem.
We are in an early era of all of these somewhat radical reforms, like you mentioned, in California, Arizona, Iowa, Florida, across the country. The data we're getting back, we're just starting to try to learn lessons from it. And the encouraging thing is voters are leading these initiatives, and the Supreme Court and all federal courts are largely saying if the voters lead these initiatives, provided they don't conflict with certain heightened scrutiny of protected classes and other constitutional concerns, the courts are saying, voters, you have the ability to do this. You have this tool of democracy if you want to change the system.
And money in politics is another topic that you all have brought up on this tour. Is there, when we look at the issues, the biggest federal issues, are there particular issues where you can kind of connect that thread between gerrymandering, the influence of money in politics, and how it's impacted Washington's ability to act or not act on certain issues? Patrick Murphy.
Yeah, absolutely. All of these issues that we talk about are really connected. The money, the media. And the other piece of that is really understanding this core problem with the gerrymandering that I think Dave and I would agree is that the biggest problem that kind of starts all of this. 90% of congressional districts are predetermined to be Republican or be Democratic. And if you're in, say, a safe Republican seat, the only election that really matters is that primary, because no Democrat will ever beat you, right, in your general election. So you got to go win a primary. In that primary, the average turnout is around 15%. So you've got to appeal to that 15%, and then the general, you're already in. It's over. So 15% of the country, in other words, is determining 90% of your members of Congress. Now, in order to appeal to that 15%, you need some money. So you're going to go raise that money. You're going to say whatever message is going to work to them. Oftentimes, that's a more extreme message on either side of the aisle. And then the media, of course, is going to play that up, those more extreme views. And the more you're on TV, the more money you're going to raise, right? And the more money you raise, the longer you're going to be, the longer you're there, the more likely it is you can probably gerrymander a district.
Now, you all worked together in Congress, you know, prior to this and knew each other, worked together closely. You know, we often hear from our representatives in Washington, and particularly in California, it's something we hear a lot from our senior Senator Dianne Feinstein, that you'd be surprised how close Republicans and Democrats are in the Capitol when they're not, you know, voting on bills or writing bills, debating bills. I'm wondering if that civility, if that matters at all when we see that the actual results can oftentimes be so polarized.
I do think, and this is probably, I would point to the impact of money on this. When Senator Feinstein and others speak to the collegiality across the aisle in the Senate, I think it is there, but we don't see it by voting performance. And the reason I think we don't see it by voting performance is because the emergence of the last 20 years of money in politics. The reality is, particularly for Senate races that can cost $100 million, the priority for that senator to get reelected might be, we'll speak to collegiality, but I need to make sure I've got $100 million worth of donations coming in. And the way you do that is through a strictly partisan voting performance behavior.
Patrick Murphy?
This is one of the least reported issues that David and I talk about, is the lack of relationships up there, because members of Congress historically would move to Washington, D.C. Their families were friends and they'd hang out on weekends and they got to know each other. And there's a really important piece to that, whether it's in business or your family, and certainly in politics when you're dealing with such controversial issues, you need that basic level of trust. That's no longer there. And what's even worse than the Democrats and Republicans not talking to each other, and the fact that leadership really doesn't want you to talk to each other for their own, you know, particular party power, is within the parties now. You're seeing a real breakdown and a real divide amongst Republicans, say between the, you know, the Tea Party and the moderates, and, you know, the more progressive Democrats and the moderate Democrats. And you're seeing all these fractures start to happen where people are really only hanging out and socializing with that small group of people and not getting to know the other side. And so we're all becoming more rigid in our views. And that's not just the voters, that's the politicians.
All right, Patrick Murphy, David Jolly, thanks so much for coming on to Political Breakdown.
Thank you very much.
And that was our producer, Guy Marzorati, in conversation with former Congressman David Jolly and Patrick Murphy. That'll do it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer, as you just heard, is Guy Marzorati, and our engineers are Seal Muller and Katie McMurrin.
Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor, and Holly Kernan is our chief content officer.
I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me at Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me at M Lagos. That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. Enjoy those leftovers. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you next week.
Gobble, gobble.